Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Professional Responsibilities and Legal Education Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, July 11th, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call as we discuss the least dangerous branch in our legal classics series. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome back three returning experts to our teleforum series, this again on legal classics. We'll have a moderator today, James A. Haynes. He's recently retired, Jim, congratulations on that, but also still serving as a volunteer leader of our practice groups. He'll be moderating the discussion, and he'll introduce our two guests and take it from there. With that, Mr. Haynes, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Dean. We're indeed honored to have two distinguished academics, both of them in California in a different time zone. Professor Ron Rotunda, Ronald Rotunda, is a professor of law at the Chapman, I beg your pardon. Let me try this again. Professor Ronald Rotunda is the Doyle and the D. Henley Chair and Distinguished Professor of Jurisprudence at the Chapman University School of Law, and Dean Erwin Chemerinsky is Dean and Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of California at Irvine. We are here to discuss what some people would probably consider a dusty old tome from the last century, a book that 54 or 55 years old, depending on how you count it, originally published in 1962, Alexander Bickel's book, The Least Dangerous Branch, The Supreme Court at the Bar of Politics. I will sort of briefly sort of set the book up for those members of our audience who are younger than I am. The book really touches upon three points and kind of draws its life, I think, from those three. First, of course, is Federalist Paper number 78, written by Alexander Hamilton, which supplies the title, The Least Dangerous Branch. And as we all know, Alexander Hamilton here tries to defend the novel kind of Article III concept of national courts to go with a national government. The novelty itself raised questions and worries among those Americans who were going to ratify or not ratify the Constitution. Hamilton tried to explain that the courts themselves were, quote, least dangerous, close quote, because they could not affect society on their own, but must always rely upon an elected executive and a representative and elected legislature. And the courts, as Hamilton put it, had neither the power of the purse or of the sword of the executive or the purse of the legislature. The second sort of pillar or foundation of this book is the case of Marbury versus Madison, Chief Justice Marshall's opinion, which established the doctrine of judicial review, which has been with us ever since. And that is based on a sort of simple construction that no matter what else the Constitution is, it's a law. No matter what else the Supreme Court is, it's a court. And the Supreme Court is bound by its very nature, by definition, to review any act of Congress to assure that those acts do not conflict with the higher law, that is the Constitution. The third kind of foundation, which gives this book much of its energy, actually is the social, cultural, and political event, most tightly focused, I guess, on September 29th, 1962, October 1st, 1962, when a man named James Meredith became the first black man to be enrolled at the University of Mississippi, Ole Miss. And the question that arises out of this book, in one sense, may be how Alexander Hamilton and John Marshall managed to affect and remain relevant to the events on a day and a night down in Mississippi. And with that in mind, I will return to my beginning and say that I'm pleased that we have two academics here, because in a sense the question before us is whether this old book should still be required reading, whether it should merely be suggested reading, or whether in fact it should be demoted to further reading. We have a professor and a dean who have prepared many course outlines and many reading lists. So I guess I would begin with Professor Rotunda and ask, where would you put this book, required, suggested, or further?
How about relevant? We have so many things to read now. There's whole new areas the courts open up with, like sexual autonomy, homosexual marriage, and so on, that was not in anybody's eye at the time Bickel wrote. So we just have a lot of work to just keep up with what the present law is. On the other hand, Bickel deals with timely issues or timeless issues. How far should the court go? Should we be should the court be Platonic guardians? The Federalist 78 rejected that. Some people think today that the court is going down that road, that they're just simply announcing things, 5-4 opinions, where the court makes major policy decisions. And that's what Bickel's talking about. It was relevant when John Marshall first brought it up, and that important issue is both relevant and very important today.
Erwin, Professor Dean Chemerinsky, we're going to roll up our sleeves and I guess use first names occasionally.
Please.
What are your reading lists looking by? Required, suggested, further, relevant?
Suggested. I like Ron's term of relevant. I think Least Dangerous Branch is a very important book in terms of American constitutional law and American jurisprudence. It's about the role of the federal courts and the Supreme Court in American society. That's as timely now as was published 55 years ago. I think that it is foundational in terms of understanding the debate over the methods of constitutional interpretation that have occurred since. I think all of the debates over originalism and non-originalism and the like really can be traced back to Least Dangerous Branch, so that makes it important. Bickel has a very definite view about the appropriate role of the federal courts in American government, American society. He refers to it as the passive virtues. So I think all of these make it an important book for people to still be aware of. Also, it's a very elegantly written, very well-written book, and so I think there's benefit in reading it. On the other hand, what you can assign to students is inherently limited. If I was going to be teaching a course on constitutional theory, probably want to draw some excerpts from this book. I'd want the students to be aware of it, but it's not one of the books that I would require. And certainly in a basic constitutional law class, there's just not time to require books like this.
Yeah, could I add something else to Erwin?
Absolutely.
About how beautifully written the book is. We really should appreciate two things. First of all, legal writing, excuse me, I have this cough, legal writing can be written well. It doesn't have to be full of the passive voice as opposed to the passive virtues. And secondly, it's particularly significant that Bickel did this. He was born in 1924 in Romania. He did not come to the United States until 1939. English was his second language. And it's just another tribute, I think, to the genius of Alexander Bickel. Even when we disagree with him, we'll have to admit that he presents his argument both in a well-written, lively written style, and he marshals the best arguments you have for his position.
Well, you have both mentioned the passive virtues, and that certainly is one of the touchstones of the book. Erwin, would you share with what your thoughts are in terms of what the passive virtues?
Sure. Alexander Bickel and the justice that he clerked for, Felix Frankfurter, had the view that the court's credibility is inherently limited, that the Supreme Court, lacking the power of the sword in the purse, taking the language from Federalist 78, had to rely on its credibility and institutional legitimacy in order to be able to have its decisions complied with. And so Bickel wanted a theory of judicial review that very much circumscribed the role of the court so it wouldn't squander its institutional capital. And it was reflected, for example, in Felix Frankfurter's strong dissent in Baker versus Carr. Baker versus Carr was the case where the Supreme Court, 1962, said that federal courts can hear challenges to malapportionment of legislatures. Earl Warren, when he stepped down as Chief Justice, was asked what was the most important rulings during his time, and he said Baker versus Carr, in the case that followed, like Reynolds versus Sims, but articulated one person, one vote. Frankfurter thought that the court should not enter the political thicket, that the passive virtues are the court should leave this to the political process. So Bickel was a very strong advocate of this idea of judicial restraint, and judicial restraint especially so as to preserve the legitimacy and credibility of the court, because Bickel believed that's all the court had in order for its decisions to be complied with. So that's at least how I define passive virtues. Maybe we'll have time to talk about why I think Bickel was completely wrong.
Well, before you move on to why Bickel is completely wrong, the passive virtues arise out of another term that I guess Bickel is credited with coining, whether somebody else put it in a footnote or not before him. He certainly popularized it, and that is the counter-majoritarian difficulty. Ron, could you help me out with?
Yes, you know, we basically live in a democracy. Now, the framers did not believe in what dictatorship by the proletariat, to borrow Marx's phrase. They knew plebiscites are historically the tools of dictators, not of democracies. So they created democracy, but with various checks and balances to try to protect their rights. Initially, the primary checks and balances were in separation of powers, that is, dividing power between the state and federal governments, and within the federal government, dividing power within the legislative branch, thought the most dangerous branch, having different methods of selection to protect the smaller states in the Senate. At that point, indirect election of the senators, because the state legislature would elect the senators. Then the president with his special roles. And then a role for the courts. I mean, Federalist 78 does articulate a role for the courts to protect us. Now, shortly after, and in fact in response to the ratification, people said we also ought to have a Bill of Rights, basically. And the framers, a lot of them thought that those would be what they call chains of parchment, that just having nice phrases would not check the government, the state and federal governments. That's why they wanted the various separation of powers. But they also added this bill, and this goes back, from the very beginning, when Federal 78 says we don't want to be governed by Platonic dictators. The judges are supposed to represent the law, not just their will and judgment. And then you go to Carolyn Product's footnote 4, where the court says that when we are invalidating things, we should have more powers, or when we're talking about rights that are particularly articulated in the Constitution, like speech and religion and so on, that when we're looking at search and seizure, it gives us a role to balance as reasonable searches and seizures. But when we have rules that are unmoored from the language of the Constitution, the pre-1937 courts saying there's a constitutional right to be paid less than the minimum wage, those things, Bickel and footnote 4 and a lot of people said that the court should be a lot more reluctant then. And we see the concern of Bickel writing shortly after, within, two decades, of the court packing plan of 1937, where Roosevelt was very popular. He was going to pack the court. fortunately, the court had enough prestige and friends in Congress, and including many of FDR's party, to stop the court packing. But then the court also ended up changing its mind, conserving, if you will, its powers for more dramatic issues. And when they went to something like desegregating the schools, that was unanimous. Even when you talk about the reapportionment decisions, the court ends up giving us more democracy, not less. It says everybody, one person, one vote. But if the farmers want to, if the city folk want to give a lot of powers to the farmers, they can still vote for the farmers. But you can't do that by having what rotten boroughs, districts so disproportionate that one person's vote has 10 or 20 times the power of another. I think in general, Frankfurter just thought the court ought to do less. But I think there's time for the court to do more, certainly to protect things like speech and religion and all the rights expressly or impliedly derived from the Bill of Rights, is asking for the court to do something. And I don't want to go on too long here, but another important point, I think even Marshall recognized this, because when he starts giving examples in Marbury v. Madison about what the court can do, the examples are really easy ones. You need two witnesses to the same overt act for treason. What if Congress said only one will do? Well, that's something that comes right before us as a court. We're not going to accept that. Or what another example was, no tariff on exports. And somebody has exports cotton, there's a tariff, he goes to court to get his money back. Well, that's a pretty straightforward rule. And in those cases, the court has more power. And Marshall, the only time that he invalidated a federal law, or possibly the only time, there was a brief case some years later, he understood that the court can't do everything, and the people don't want to be governed by Platonic dictators.
All right. Now, that sort of brings us back. I didn't want Irwin to forget why Alexander Bickel is wrong about all of this in terms of the passive virtues. So I did want to give him a chance to kind of develop that comment. But just to show that I remember something from Bar Review, I would guess the passive virtues include how you get into court, standing, the quality of the issue presented. Is it a case or controversy? Is it ripe? Is it a political question? Is it justiciable? And finally, perhaps how the court, assuming that the legal matter makes it through all of those other hoops, upon what grounds should the court decide? Does that pretty well cover a generic list of what Bickel would have called the passive virtues, Irwin?
Yes, he would say that the court should use the doctrines that you just enumerated to stay away from the kind of issues that would undermine the court's credibility. But maybe before we get to the passive virtues, if I could respond to Ron in terms of the counter-majoritarian difficulty, and then use that as a transition to the passive virtues, because I actually disagree with both Ron and with Bickel in terms of the counter-majoritarian difficulty. Bickel in The Least Dangerous Branch refers to judicial review as, quote, a deviant institution in American democracy, because he says democracy means majority rule, and the federal judiciary is unelected. The federal judiciary is striking down the laws, the actions of the elected branches of government. And Ron repeated this notion that American democracy is the core of our government, and democracy means majority rule. I don't think American democracy means majority rule. The framers were very distrustful of the majority. Look at the institutions that they created in the Constitution. The president isn't chosen by majority rule. The president is chosen by the Electoral College. The Senate at the time the Constitution was ratified was chosen by state legislatures. The federal judiciary is picked by the president and the Senate. Only the House of Representatives was chosen by the people directly. And I think the more profound point is, the Constitution is inherently anti-majoritarian. The Constitution was written by no one today. Most of us didn't have ancestors in the country. We can't change it by majority vote. And so it's the Constitution that's deviant relative to democracy defined as majority rule. Judicial review that enforces the Constitution is inherently anti-majoritarian. It's meaningless to criticize judicial review for being anti-democratic when what it's doing is enforcing a document, the Constitution, that's anti-democratic. And in terms of passive virtues, I think that the role of the court is to interpret and enforce the Constitution, not to preserve judicial credibility. I don't share Frankfurter and Bickel's premise that the court's credibility is fragile. I think decisions that are controversial at the time, like Brown versus Board of Education, only have enhanced the court's credibility. And I think that the passive virtues have real costs if it keeps the courts from enforcing the Constitution. Gerald Gunther, another of the greats of the same generation as Bickel, wrote a terrific response to Bickel titled The Subtle Vices of the Passive Virtues. If the passive virtues mean that the court's not enforcing the Constitution, then it's not doing its job. I'll give one quick example. The issue came before the Supreme Court as to whether state laws that prohibited interracial marriage violated the Constitution. And the Supreme Court practiced the passive virtues and in a case called Name versus Name, dismissed on justiciability grounds. And it wasn't until later in Loving versus Virginia in 1967 that the court found that laws prohibiting interracial marriage violate the Constitution. The court was wrong to duck that issue in Name versus Name. Laws that prohibit interracial marriage were wrong in Loving, they were wrong in Name, they were wrong when the 14th Amendment was adopted. The passive virtues led to not so subtle vices there.
Could I...
Absolutely.
First of all, I don't think... The United States has never understood democracy to mean majority rule, period. The historians, political scientists, they refer to the United States as a liberal democracy. I don't think liberal versus conservative, but democracy subject to individual rights, subject to liberties. And the various sections in the Constitution, well, some of them were, of course, held slavery. We were born in original sin, the compromise necessary to get one nation. But others, like the division between state and federal and within the federal government, the purposes were to preserve and limit the power of the central government and have some limitations on the power of the states. Now, Irwin, is certainly true that nobody today wrote the Constitution, and very few are even related to any of the people that wrote it. But you know, that's true of the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1897. That was passed by a bunch of old white men, too. And the framers thought of that. They had a procedure to amend the Constitution. They thought that we should have a Constitution that protects our rights. The Constitution should be written. If it's not going to, why write it if you're not going to look at the writing? Now, I think it is correct that the court in the past has sometimes ducked issues in ways that seem really kind of hokey. And it's just as important for the court to enforce the Constitution and invalidate laws than to make up rules while invalidating laws. And I think that's what the essence of Bickel is. What the essence of Bickel is saying, that the court should be careful when it's creating rules that don't have any kind of mooring in the Constitution. Now, I think we're a lot more accepting of what the court's done than in the past. I think people like Frankfurter would be surprised how most people saw the one-person, one-vote rules to be sound. People thought that it made sense. Why should my vote count 10 times more than you because you live 10 feet across a dotted line? I think that's all acceptable. The recent gay marriage cases were unusual for a couple of reasons. I think one is that the nation is becoming more libertarian. It is popular to say if gays want to get married, let them get married and let them suffer like the rest of us. But the court's decision in that case, it was 5-4. They don't bother talking about the language of the argument. They refer to their earlier case and prior cases, saying that there is no right to gay marriage. They say, well, now we think there is. They give a bone towards religious beliefs, but don't really suggest much of it one way or the other. Scalia says in dissent, if you treat this case as kind of logical, what's the logical difference between what he calls a throuple, that is, a three-person marriage where all parties may be bisexual. And I realize the court, when it decides one case, can't decide all the permutations that come from it, but if they spend a little more time in their rationale, it would be a little easier for the lower courts to follow it. So I think a difference, I suppose, I think between Harlan and Frankfurter is Frankfurter in general just tried not to decide cases, sometimes maybe making hokey reasons to get out on the basis of standing. And Harlan had a better sense of justice. I think it was less, more reluctant to pick up hokey barriers. So Justice Black, who focused a lot on the language of the Constitution, was very broad when it came to First Amendment, because after all, there it is, Congress shall make no law. More reluctant when it came to the implied rights that come from other implied rights that come from the General Due Process Clause. So I think there's a balance there, and the general principle of Bickel that the courts ought to be careful is correct. Though I agree with Irwin that courts don't say, gee, you know, how will this play in the election returns? They shouldn't be deciding popularity contests.
I thank you for that response. I also had the benefit of reading Irwin's post on the SCOTUS blog, sort of running commentary from a number of different scholars and others with an interest about Alexander Bickel, and I wanted to ask, to the extent that you talk about the counter-majoritarian difficulty and find it as being strictly about majorities, doesn't that sort of underrate the notion, which is pretty fixed in American history, at least, that the people are sovereign and hold political power, that in 1776 or 1789, that the United States was massively more democratic than any other nation at that time, and that whether we think now that our Constitution, as written in those days, was kind of remarkably reactionary, it's still the Constitution was still sort of a part of a culture or an ethos of state and local governments with town meetings and elections that were ubiquitous for a century before the Declaration of Independence was even written. To be sure, we're more majoritarian today than we were. But was Bickel really simply, although he talks about a counter-majoritarian name for the idea that he's trying to offer up, is it really simply about whether the Constitution is kind of a break on majority rule or, in fact, fosters majority rule? I don't know if that question was particularly clear, but I hope that it is.
I think the answer is the Constitution both fosters majority rule and is a break on majority rule. The Constitution fosters majority rule in that it creates institutions that are elected by the people, but it also is a break on majority rule in that it is a constraint on government. It is the whole point of Marbury versus Madison, limits on government, and that's why we have judicial review. Of course, the people are sovereign, but this is a constitutional democracy, not a pure democracy. Now, Ron raises the example of the Sherman Antitrust Act. A majority of Congress can change the Sherman Antitrust Act. A majority of Congress can't change the Constitution. It takes a supermajority in both Congress and the states to change the Constitution. And the question, of course, is why does a nation that sees itself as a democracy want to be governed by a document that's so difficult to change? And that's because the Constitution is meant to be constraints. It's meant to be about limits on what the majority can do. Now, of course, what Ron says is right. all justices, all commentators start with the words of the Constitution, but they generally don't answer the questions that courts, that society has to face right now. And all decisions are moored in the text of the Constitution. Take, for example, one person, one vote. It's derived from the right to vote, which can be found in the 15th Amendment. It can be found with regard to equal protection in the 14th Amendment. I think that the Supreme Court cases about marriage equality are clearly moored in the Constitution. Laws that prohibited same-sex marriage unquestionably discriminate against gays and lesbians. The question then is, at the very least, do they meet rational basis review? Is there some legitimate government reason for denying gays and lesbians the right to marry? That's very much moored in the Constitution. Every Supreme Court decision is moored in the language of the Constitution, and that's the Constitution that's meant to be both, to go where you ask the question, facilitating democracy and limiting democracy.
Well, your average Bar Association luncheon where they're handing out awards to everybody, generally there are some Supreme Court decisions that are not mentioned. Korematsu,
yeah.
Which appeared to, which in fact said there's no constitutional right not to be sent to a concentration camp by your government. Plessy, of course, Dred Scott, which did not exercise the passive virtues, but went on. Chief Justice Taney of Maryland went on to kind of lecture the whole country about how they had misunderstood both the Constitution and slavery. Do these opinions, sort of taken singly or as a group, argue more in favor of the court being restrained in at least not holding as it did in these three? And I grant you that. Baker versus Carr, Brown versus the Board of Education, the recent decisions on same-sex marriage, and perhaps the decisions on the Affordable Care Act, are kind of a bowl of golden apples right now. But there are some rotten apples in the barrel. Does that change your view about the way that Bickel urged caution on the court?
Ron here, I think that those are cases where the court should have just applied the Constitution, and the Japanese exclusion cases are a sad chapter in American history. There were some dissents, and the court seemed to leap to the protection of the central government and granted in time of war, when they should have been a lot more cautious and look to the language of not just the language of the Constitution. Irwin is right that a lot of the language is hardly very clear, but it's not a virtue to be passive when faced with a major issue of civil liberties like that. That is, United States without trial imprisoning U.S. citizens, and oddly enough, only the Japanese, not the Italians or the Germans, though we were at war with them, and only on the West Coast, where they seem to have a lot of property that other people wanted. There's all kinds of things wrong with that, and the court then, its error, I think, was turning the other cheek rather than responding to the case before them.
So when should the court apply its judicial review powers? Either one of you, whoever hits the button first.
Yeah. Sure. Let me respond to your earlier question, and I'm glad to take that one on. In terms of your earlier question, I published a book that came out a couple of years ago titled The Case Against the Supreme Court. And my thesis was that the Supreme Court has often failed, often the most important tasks, often the most important times. And I certainly would point to examples like you do, Dred Scott, Plessy versus Ferguson, Korematsu. Interestingly, some of those instances, the court was siding with the government and being passive, Korematsu, Plessy, sometimes striking down laws, Dred Scott. Now, I think the question is, in light of the Supreme Court's historic failure, what do we do about it? Some, Gerald Rosenberg, Mark Tushnet would say, well, we eliminate judicial review. I don't think so, because I think that Marbury versus Madison was right. The Constitution exists to limit government. Those limits have meaning only if they're enforced. I think we focus on how do we improve the judiciary to make such mistakes less likely to occur in the future. Now, in terms of the answer to your question, I think the preeminent role of the federal courts is to interpret the Constitution. I think that overall we are better off as a society having an institution that's largely insulated from direct majoritarian politics and having it interpret the Constitution and give it modern meaning.
Well, I mean, I concur. I think we'll disagree about the details, but the court is become the most powerful court in the world. I think it is a beacon to courts around the world that you see more and more constitutional courts in Eastern Europe as well as Western Europe, the Court of Human Rights and so on with the European Union, the newly emerging democracies, even in Asia. They look to courts to protect their rights, I think because of the model of the United States. And on the whole, the court's done very well. Though there's a lot of specific decisions where, well, we'll wait and see whether they end up with something like the economic due process cases in the pre-1937 court. There are a lot of people unhappy with the court, but I think if the choice were no court or the court, they'd want to have the court to protect their rights. Whether the court is going too far with some of the modern cases, well, only time will tell.
In fairness, I mean, we can all agree that Alexander Bickel wasn't writing this whole long book in order to simply conclude that judicial review was a bad thing and should be abolished. And we're all in agreement on that. One of the sort of I would almost say endearing qualities of this book is that from time to time, Bickel does choose to embrace either history or real life, and in the text of his book. And I was struck by the significance that he gives to Abraham Lincoln's long kind of war with the Supreme Court and with Chief Justice Taney. About Dred Scott and the way in which Lincoln grappled with the idea of, well, the court has made a constitutional ruling, but the ruling is such a fabric that it is still possible to argue politically against it. I think that is at least a rough summary of the position that Lincoln held for, what, a decade. And the book, of course, closes with the episode of James Meredith and the desegregation of Ole Miss, which I'd mentioned earlier. Do you think that this book is either stronger or that it's somehow diluted by the Lincoln example and the James Meredith example? Would it have been a better book if Bickel perhaps had stayed more within the purity of sort of an academic view of the Constitution?
Well, either one. I want to modify the Lincoln quote. Lincoln, one of the things he objected to is the whole government being bound by a rule between two private parties in a private case. Lincoln was not a part of Dred Scott. He objected to the whole country saying we can no longer argue this because Dred Scott said that in the nature of things, blacks, even freed blacks, can never be citizens. He didn't argue that we should ignore the court, but he said I shouldn't be bound by a decision to which I'm not a part. So there's a big difference between Lincoln saying I object to this opinion and ultimately getting an act of the 13th Amendment overturning it, and Orville Faubus standing in the schoolhouse, or George Wallace standing in the schoolhouse door and say, we will not obey the case to which we are a party. There is a procedure to get those decisions overturned, and that's called appeal. So I don't think that Lincoln is saying we should have the right to disobey the president. And when you think about Ole Miss, it is also true that in practice people just don't necessarily accept what the court does. And it was very important in those cases for the president of the United States, I think it was to start off being Eisenhower, giving very strong support to what the Supreme Court did. And that's a tribute to Eisenhower when he federalized the National Guard, and it's a tribute to our democratic system that splits power between the state and federal government, because the National Guard is under the control of the governor, but then it could be federalized. So that was a very good use of the example of the president supporting the court. Had the president refused to support the court, that would have been most unfortunate.
May I answer your question in a slightly different way? Because I think the premise of your question is that there's something that's separate between theory and practice, or theory and social events, and I just don't accept that divide. I think that theory has to be grounded in the events of the world, and the events of the world have to be understood from the perspective of theory. So I think it was completely appropriate for Bickel to talk about what was going on in the world at the time, which is about civil rights. The reality is, I don't think that the University of Mississippi would have been integrated when it was, but for Brown versus Board of Education. And one of the things that, unfortunately, Bickel was very critical of was Brown versus Board of Education. I think that there's no doubt that the Supreme Court was wrong in Dred Scott, and I agree with what Ron said in terms of President Lincoln's reaction, all of which is a reminder the Supreme Court is made up of human beings, and they're part of the society where they live. Dred Scott was tragically wrong. Brown versus Board of Education was heroically right, but that's the reality in which Bickel's writing, that's the reality in which we teach and practice law.
I should clarify, if I didn't, that I agree with you that that in both cases, both historical examples, that Bickel's writing is more clear and more compelling, because he chooses to talk about the law as he was trying to explain it, as illuminated by events. I agree with Ron that with regard to Abraham Lincoln and the Dred Scott decision, that Lincoln is an example both politically and rhetorically, intellectually, analytically, of how one can argue against a Supreme Court decision while still acknowledging the legitimacy of that decision. And I agree also that the civil rights struggle from Little Rock to Ole Miss and ongoing often has been an example of how not to approach an error or a perceived error in a Supreme Court decision. And that is how, I guess, I see Alexander Bickel ending his book with a cautionary example for people who want to think about Supreme Court cases and to either agree or disagree with them. That in Bickel's sort of world, Lincoln is good, and I guess it was Ross Barnett was the governor of Mississippi. Would either of you like to sort of sum up, and then perhaps we can have a few questions?
Ron, here, I'll just add another commenting thing instead of summing up.
Sure.
Henry Calvin at the University of Chicago wrote an important book in that time. I think it's called The First Amendment and the Negro. And what he pointed out was that it's not simply the court's decisions on equal protection that granted these rights. It was a protection for free speech, assembly, meeting, protesting, because we got these rights not simply by court order, but by large-scale protests, giving people the right to vote, and giving it also to the blacks down south. And we don't have these rights simply by the court issuing is ipsa dixits. Sometimes people have to peacefully protest in the streets, and the sit-ins, during the 1960s, the demonstrations, they were all very important in implementing Brown v. Board of Education, though they come under a very different clause, the First Amendment, rather than applied to the state through the 14th, rather than Section 1 of the 14th directly. So we have to fight for our own rights. The court is not an excuse for either the legislative branches to ignore their rules, saying, you know, well, the court can always overturn us, nor is it an excuse for people themselves not to be sure. It's not an excuse for people to be lackadaisical. We always have to fight for our rights.
You asked for a summary. I think where Ron and I would agree is that Alexander Bickel wrote an elegant book about the role of the court in society, that the issues that he was discussing about the proper role of the judiciary are timeless ones, and that the book really has played a very important role in the development of constitutional theory ever since.
Well, I think I agree with that, and perhaps we can ask Dean if anyone has any questions or any comments on the work that we've tried to do here.
Let's open the floor to questions then. Thank you, gentlemen. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Looks like we begin today with one question.
This is David Applegate of the Chicago Lawyers Chapter. This doesn't relate directly to Alexander Bickel's book, but perhaps coincidentally, the front page of the New York Times today featured an article quoting Ruth Bader Ginsburg, is stating that if a certain presidential candidate is elected, that it may be time to move to New Zealand, speculating on what would have happened in U.S. versus Texas, which of course was a 4-4 tie, had Justice Scalia still been alive, saying that she would love to see Citizens United overturned, in calling District of Columbia versus Heller, which recognized the Second Amendment right of the people to keep and bear arms, is a very bad decision. Independent of this particular justice, the particular presidential candidate she may have had in mind, and the specific cases she mentioned, do any of the speakers think that these are appropriate topics, including what would have happened in certain cases had other justices been able to participate? What are the views of the speakers on whether these are appropriate topics for public discussion of a current sitting Supreme Court justice?
We're in a new era. Things have changed in recent years. Justice Scalia frequently gave speeches, including about matters that were going to be before the court. Justice Breyer wrote a book and did lots of interviews. Sonia Sotomayor appeared on Sesame Street and dropped the ball at Times Square on New Year's Eve. I read the article this morning, the interview that Justice Ginsburg gave with Adam Liptak. There was nothing in it that was surprising. The only thing that was surprising was that she chose to say it.
I think that the examples Irwin gives are really not at all, not at all justifying Ginsburg's very political statement. He said, you can't imagine how the country would be with Donald Trump as our president. It would be time to move to New Zealand. That Congress has a constitutional obligation. No hearings now. These are all inappropriate for a judge. Now, I recall one case where Scalia did make a comment, I think in response to a question about the Pledge of Allegiance with the language in it under God, one nation under God. He disqualified himself when that case came up. He should not have made the statement. He was proper in disqualifying himself. I think Justice Ginsburg does no favors to the court when she says and apparently believes that she's just a political actor and gives a list of the cases she's going to overturn. So I think it's unfortunate that she says that, and it's unfortunate that she thinks it.
Can I strongly disagree? I see nothing inappropriate with what she said. Antonin Scalia talked about the physician-assisted death case right before it came to the Supreme Court and made it clear that he was ridiculing the idea there was such a right in the Constitution, and yet he participated. What cases did she talk about in the interview? Citizens United, where she dissented. District of Columbia versus Heller, where she dissented. There's no doubt what her views are. I certainly don't think judges should express their views on pending cases. Neither is pending before the court, and nor is there any question what she's going to come out with regard to this. Justice Scalia repeatedly off the bench criticized Roe versus Wade. How is that any different than this? In terms of her expressing her views with regard to Donald Trump being elected as president, I don't think that in any way biases her as a justice. I don't think that judges or justices lose their free speech rights by putting on the robes. I thought there was nothing in the interview that was surprising, other than she chose to say these things, and judges usually don't.
I would try to tie this back to Alexander Bickel a little bit and just ask whether or not our two panelists think that the kind of underlying assumption that Bickel must have had in 1962 and earlier when he was writing this book of the Supreme Court's role as one of three branches of government, how that has changed to the extent that one could argue we have a fairly dysfunctional Congress, and one could argue that we have an executive that is very aggressive in terms of pursuing certain administrative actions, which might previously have been considered the proper domain of legislation rather than executive orders or executive memoranda or regulations. Do you think that anything in Bickel's book anticipates perhaps the emergence of a government not of three branches but of three different planets?
I think Ginsburg was wrong, and on that I think Irwin and I can agree to disagree.
In terms of your question about dysfunctional government, this isn't the first time that government has been dysfunctional. Often when you have the president of one political party and a Congress of another, there's great tensions between them. In the 19th century, about 20% of judicial nominees got rejected by the Senate. We've had other instances in this century where in the Senate and the president of different political parties, nominees being rejected. There are times when presidents have exercised more power. Arthur Schlesinger is the imperial presidency, but also times when presidents have exercised less in the way of power. So I always want to be careful about generalizing too much from any moment in time or proclaiming that any moment in time is truly unique. We've seen these kinds of things. We've seen polarization in society before.
Very good. And anyone have anything else to say in response to the last question? Dean, do we have anyone else?
We do have one question pending. I think we have time for this question. Maybe even another question. If you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's head in the direction of our next caller.
Mike Tremoglia from the Philadelphia chapter and also the co-founder of the Italian chapter. And I bring that up for a reason. I think something was said here that was illustrative of the lack of omniscience of judges and college law professors. And that is that someone mentioned that the Italians and Germans were not sent to internment camps during World War II. That is patently untrue. Both Italians and Germans were sent to internment camps. They were, even though there was no surprise attack by Italy or Germany on Puerto Rico. There was no threat of invasion by Germany or Italy, as there was on the West Coast during World War II. And I know this because I had relatives who were stationed out there then. So, you know, when you make judgments that the courts are should be the last word on issues, you must be careful because it is impossible to know everything. And there are just as many instances—well, I don't know if there are just as many, but there are instances where a legislature passed a law, and I think it was Groves versus Slaughter in Mississippi back in 1836, and they prohibited the importation of slaves, slaves taken into that state, and the Supreme Court reversed that. So, you know, the Supreme Court is not omniscient, nor is it always does the right thing, and it could just as easily rule against the legislature when the legislature did the right thing as vice versa.
Of course that's right. If I could just say several things. First, you're correct. Germans and Italians in very limited numbers were interned.
Please don't qualify saying very limited numbers. That bespeaks some type of qualification that, well, it was less egregious than what happened. You know, it was the same for, you know, an Italian interned in an internment camp in Wyoming is no different than a Japanese or a German. And there were people that were interned during World War One. There were Czechs and Slavics and
may
other
I respond,
Europeans
please?
That were interned. Okay.
May I respond, please?
Well, I mean, I'm just you're trying to make a qualification there.
May I have the chance
respond.
To talk?
Let him respond.
Well, you guys, you've been talking.
No,
I'll go back to what I said. Of course, for any person who's interned, it's a terrible deprivation of liberty. The numbers, all my point was, the smaller number of Italian Americans and German Americans were interned than Japanese Americans was 110,000 individuals. I don't believe that any person ever should be incarcerated or interned on the basis of race alone or ethnicity. We don't determine dangerousness on the basis of race or ethnicity. It was wrong to do it to Japanese Americans. It was wrong to do it to Italian Americans. It was wrong to do it to German Americans. Of course, the court is not omniscient, and the court doesn't know everything. The court can make mistakes, and I believe the court has often made mistakes through American history. But I still believe we are much better off with a judiciary to enforce the Constitution and to interpret the Constitution than we would be without the institution of judicial review. They're human beings, and they make mistakes, but I think we're better off for just the reasons John Marshall said in Marbury versus Madison.
And add to that Irwin's comment. The U.S. interned Italian nationals, not U.S. Italian citizens, not even long-term U.S. residents who had not yet gotten their citizenship. They interned less than 2,000 Italian nationals. That's quite common during war. The diplomats are sent home to each other, and then the nationals either are sent away or they're interned. Now, they were picked, but they were not U.S. citizens. At least said they were not intended to be the ones who were U.S. citizens. My father and mother came from the old country. They were not interned, nor my grandparents who came from the old country. My father did fight in World War II as a spy for the Americans. He spoke Italian like a native, actually even better than a native, because he spoke it with a dialect that they don't teach any place in the United States. But there's a difference between interning U.S. citizens and people because of their nationality, and it's quite common to inter enemy aliens during wartime.
Jim, this is Dean. Do we have time for a final question? We do have one more question on the line.
Gentlemen, if you have time, I would be inclined to. Anybody who sat through at least my talking deserves to ask a question.
Let's see if we can squeeze this in then.
Excellent. I'll try to make it quick. Gary Wheaton up here in New Hampshire again. Quick comment first. I noticed that Professor Chominski tended to excuse one justice's behavior by pointing to another. That's my comment. Don't agree. My question is, I haven't read that book. Is there anything in that book that deals with textualism versus originalism versus any other, I guess you would call interpretations? And that's, I'll leave it there.
I can answer in a couple of sentences. First, that's not the focus of the book, The Case Against the Supreme Court. The focus of the book is what the court has done wrong and how to make it less likely in the future. All justices are textualists. We all begin with the text of the Constitution. Whether originalism should be followed, that's another question for hopefully another opportunity to have a debate like this, discussion like this.
Thanks.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions from either Ron or Irwin? And if not, I want to thank you both for being so generous with your time. It certainly, from my standpoint, has been a pleasure. And I guess we can turn it back over to Dean.
Let me add my great appreciation to all three of our experts today. Thank you, gentlemen, for your time. A reminder to the audience to check with our website and monitor your emails for a schedule of upcoming calls. Our next scheduled call at this point is Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern time at this same number. We'll be talking about important constitutional challenges to Congress's patent reform measures and whether or not taking away a patent is taking away property. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.